Welcome to the Joint Policy Committee. So we're going to, I think we're one short possibly of a quorum. So what I'd like to do is, if you wouldn't mind, we're going to start and we'll come back to the approval of the minutes once we hopefully have the quorum. And we want to welcome Senator DeSalines here, so that's great. So we're going to go to the next item, which is actually item number 3. Report on the climate and energy resilient project, and Bruce is going to start off.
Before we get to the specific items on today's agenda, I want to do call your attention to the fact that all of the items are interrelated parts of the larger body of the work that you're engaged in. Bruce will be giving you an update on the climate and energy resilience project. And as you know, the aim of this project is to engage stakeholders from the business, environmental, equity, and academic communities to develop an action plan for dealing with all the Bay Area climate impacts, including sea level rise, so that our region can continue to prosper in the future. The next scheduled item is a briefing on the economic framework study. Unfortunately, Sean Randolph had to make a quick trip to London, so he won't be able to provide that briefing. He has, however, given us a short memo summarizing the progress that's been made on the project, and I hope you'll all be able to attend ABAG's General Assembly on October 18th when the final report on the study will be released. As you know, the purpose of the Economic Framework Project is to provide a foundation for a regional economic development strategy. And in order for such a strategy to be successful, we have to recognize that our future won't look like our past. Lots of things are changing, and our climate is one of them. If we don't have an effective strategy for adapting to climate-driven impacts, we won't have an economic development strategy that will work. Most of the laws under which we operate were enacted before there was recognition that our climate was changing. Therefore, a thoughtful discussion with Senator DeSaulnier is timely as you continue your efforts to advance economic development and to address climate change. Perhaps the seeds of some constructive changes in state law will be sown in your discussion today. And finally, we'll be taking up the issue of whether you will take on a leadership role in the formulation of a regional sea level rise adaptation strategy. We know more about sea level rise than other climate impacts in the Bay Area, so we're in a better position to begin the planning work that's needed to deal with sea level rise. We also know that some of the most important economic assets in our region, including Silicon Valley, our major port, 2 international airports, downtown San Francisco, and a number of communities are in low-lying areas that are vulnerable to flooding. We can't expect our region to remain prosperous and attractive to investors if we ignore this peril and fail to prepare an effective strategy to deal with it. So as we talk about climate change impacts, and particularly sea level rise, remember that they are indelibly linked with our economic future and that state legislation will likely be needed to help us deal with all these interrelated issues. With that overview, Bruce will bring us up to date on the Climate and Energy Resilience Project. And by the way, we do have a scout standing by, and if the space shuttle does appear, we'll adjourn for a few minutes to go out and watch it. Thanks. Bruce?
Thank you, Trav.
Hold it. It's here. If you want to go out and watch the space shuttle.
And that's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing us to do that.
Wow, we got a full fucking house. Okay, thank you for the thrilling experience. Would you want to take our seats? We'll get started again. One more time. So we clearly have a quorum, and we thank everybody for coming. And so I would like to, before we to return to the approval of the minutes of July 20th, 2012, I'd entertain a motion. Moved by Green. Is there a second? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay. Thank you very much. So now we'll go back to Bruce Reardon, who's going to talk to us about the status of the Area Climate Energy Resilience Project.
So now we'll take questions, right? just before I do my presentation, you're looking at a screenshot from our in-progress revamp of the JPC website. Trav and I have been working with ABAG to try and bring us into at least the 20th century on the JPC website, if not the 21st. So this is in progress, and we'll have something up, and we'll send you a link to it probably in about a week. So there's a memo in your packet for the update status report on the Climate and Energy Resilience Project, one of the two JPC projects we're following, that and the Economic Development Framework. So I'm going to just hit some highlights here of the Kresge Foundation grant, which we've received, our new Climate Corps Bay Area staff person, a little bit about talks we're having at Berkeley on a action do tank with UC Berkeley on climate adaptation, and a couple of others, including this alliance we've struck with our counterparts on adaptation in San Diego, Los Angeles, and Sacramento. And then I'll show you a couple of things from the Bay Area Impacts reports. So again, the problem we're trying to solve by providing a JPC-focused regional project is to try to help cities and counties and special agencies and special districts and all in the region to deal with climate adaptation in an efficient and powerful way. So specifically, we're trying to keep people from reinventing the wheel from city to city. We're trying to help cities, and it's most cities in the Bay Area that don't have the capacity right now to take these issues on. As you know, we have a number of impacts that cross city and county lines, and so, again, the regional entity can provide assistance there in working towards those impacts. Infrastructure is most often owned by somebody, and we can say they're responsible for the maintenance and in terms of climate adaptation, looking at the vulnerabilities and the adaptation strategies. But it's much more complex for our natural systems that are such a big part of the Bay Area, for health, for issues like that. So again, there's a role here that we can help play to bring those issues into more focus. And finally, we've been working with the state a fair amount now on climate adaptation, and they want a more efficient way to work with all of the cities in California than going one by one by one. So they are very excited to start working with us and with our counterparts in San Diego and LA and Sacramento that have started adaptation collaboratives like this one. The Kresge Foundation has just awarded us an initial modest grant to help to organize our collaborative. It's a six-month grant. We had given them, I think we told you before, a much bigger outline of a proposal. And they said, let's do 6 months. Let's start with that. Let's help you get a foundation put together for the work, and then we'll go from there. So They do quite large grants usually, so that's implied that that's going to be available to us in the future if we do a good job in this first 6 months. And the clock is ticking. Today is day 21 of month one. Quickly, what we're going to do with the Kresge Foundation money is take all the research that we have at this point available on climate impacts in the Bay Area and prepare a story and briefing paper that will bring that together in a cohesive manner. We are going to, Trav and I hold more than 20 stakeholder meetings, so we'll go meet with water agencies, we'll meet with a group of city managers, we'll meet with the various stakeholders who are eventually going to be involved or are involved now in climate adaptation strategies. And it's really a kind of a two-way set of meetings, but really about identifying specifically what are their needs and how can our project help those entities that are moving forward to move forward in a better way. We're also going to be doing with the Kresge money four special work plans. We will lay out how we're going to deal with certain important topics over the next couple of years. And so this is scoping, basically. The first one, Andy Gunther from Bay Area Ecosystems Climate Change Consortium, is going to do a piece for us on how do we turn research into information that's usable to policymakers and translate all of the tremendous amounts of data we have now into things that can be useful for us in terms of determining what are the biggest problems and what are the solutions. Second, Steve Weissman from Berkeley's Law School will be doing a piece for us on governance and decision-making, looking at possible options for how we deal with this when we have 101 cities, 9 counties, many special districts and all. Again, scoping out how we're going to get at that big issue and a difficult issue over the next few years. Kirsten Schwinn from Bay Localize is going to do a piece for us on how do we make sure the social equity concerns, environmental justice concerns, are an integral part of the planning as we move forward on climate adaptation in the region. And finally, Laura Sasso, who's our new Climate Corps staff person, who's here today. Laura, raise your hand. We've just hired Laura with Kresge Foundation Project Money as a Climate Corps staff person. She's going to be with us for 10 months, and her specific piece will be working on the intersection of strategies that reduce energy use and GHG reduction with strategies that also help us adapt and become more resilient. And the whole point will, in 6 months, we will decide with our partners and with all of you on an action plan for the next 12 to 18 months to move ahead, and a structure. Is this project going to stay here at the JPC? Is it going to move to a university or to a foundation? Where do we need to form a new 501c3? Where's the best place to house this kind of work in the region is one of the questions we'll be dealing with in the first 6 months. Couple of things to add to that. Trav and I have had a couple of very good meetings now, a number of them with individuals at Berkeley. We've tried with Stanford, we just haven't gotten as far, so we're continuing to try. But Berkeley's been very responsive, and you'll see the list here of a meeting we just had on Monday. This is about forming something called a do tank or an action center where we'd bring academic experts and policymakers and others together. We're looking at something that would be possibly off campus, possibly on campus. It would be a place where we could do joint research projects. It would really start to harness the tremendous knowledge and brain power that's sitting up here at Berkeley and at Stanford and at LBL and other places in the region to work with us, to work with those who are actually making decisions on moving ahead on these issues around climate adaptation. So you'll see we have kind of an all-star list here, and we asked at the end for four or five to work with us as a working group to take this to the next couple of steps, and they all volunteered. So we're doing this. It's starting to work. The key here is going to be the university system is not set up to provide incentives to faculty to do this kind of policy advising and all. It's more about science and more about research. So that's the trick, and we talked about that in the first meeting right off the bat of what sorts of incentives are we going to have to come up with to make this work. But they're very interested in doing this with us. They're looking at, Mark Richards is talking about something that would be funded at the rate of, you know, a million or two a year to run a center to do this kind of thing, and we think it has great possibilities. Trav and I have also been working now with an alliance we formed with similar adaptation collaborators like this, like our project, in San Diego, Los Angeles, and Sacramento. And we just spent 2 days in Sacramento meeting together and meeting with the Governor's Office of Planning and Research and with the various state agencies, resources, and EPA and the others that are working on climate adaptation. So you'll see some of the groups that are represented in our, we have four representatives from each region working together on this. It's really about problem solving so that San Diego solves something, we can just steal it from them, much more efficient. And they've got some, San Diego's got some terrific work done on this, same with LA. Sacramento's just starting out. It's also then developing a more, I would say, formal partnership with the state. We don't want to have, well, I'll put it positively. We want to have early input on things like the state's climate adaptation strategy, not to get it with 3 weeks to go and be asked to comment after it's been worked on for 10 months. We want to get in on the research agenda before it's set at the state level and they tell us what kinds of things they're going to be researching over the next couple of years. So we have a series of things we're working on. I won't go into all of them today, but we're making some good progress here. This is all about being more efficient and being more powerful because we're working together. Final piece of the update. The state has, and this took a few years, but they've put out now 11 studies on climate impacts in the Bay Area. This was a series of about 30 studies on California that were just published, and this is through the PEER program, which is run by California Energy Commission. And the studies on the Bay Area, these 11 are on, you know, the impacts on transportation from sea level rise, they're on impacts on the wine industry, there's a case study of Oakland in terms of community organizing and community impacts, there are a couple on public health issues. There are a whole set here, and you see their covers here. And Susie Mosier and Julie Ekstrom then have taken, the 11th is actually a summary, a 60-page summary that synthesizes the findings. So there's tons of good stuff in this and a lot for us to work on water issues, on sea level rise, on public health, on a whole set of issues. So that's very helpful, and it took a while, but we have it now, and we're just starting to go through these reports and understand how, again, we can translate that information for all of you and for others that are in the doing business and make sense of this rather detailed research. So let me just show you and finish. I'll finish up here with a couple of examples from the research. This is a paper by Chaplin Kramer at Stanford that looks at all of the research around rangeland impacts and viticulture, the wine industry. And so not original research, but looking at the existing research and summarizing. And you can see from this table first what are our most valuable crops here and grapes by far, wine grapes in the nine-county region. That's mostly, almost all in Napa and Sonoma. Pasture land, though, makes up about 80% of our agricultural land in the Bay Area, and that's primarily in Sonoma, but also Marin and Solano counties. So we have a fairly robust agricultural interest here. $2 billion worth out of the state's $36 billion a year is right here in the nine-county Bay Area. So she looked at wine industry and rangeland, and I'll just show you something about the wine industry. You want to have purple land here. It's probably a little hard for you to read the detail, but this is the optimal for quality grape growing. Okay, this is yields in most of the research. Yields in the grape in the wine industry are going to go up as things get warmer. And that looks pretty good across the board in the Bay Area, especially in the North Bay. Quality, though, is the question. And quality is what the researchers are very concerned about, because quality is where you're making lots of your money, and it's what we're known for a lot, especially in Napa and Sonoma. So the purple areas are the optimal areas now, the map at the top, now for high-quality grapes. And they've run two climate scenarios here, the B1 and the A2, These are IPCC scenarios showing warming and what happens to the purple area as you get towards the middle and the latter part of this century. The optimal area shifts to the west here, shifts obviously towards the coast. In the warmest scenario, which is the one on the right, it really shifts to places like San Francisco and San Mateo County. So,
Livermore.
Coast.
So here's the point. This is not what's going to happen. This is what can happen if we have the kind of warming that these scenarios predict. But this does not, and this is the point of our project, get at what are the adaptation strategies that you would then employ. So you don't just sit back and say, well, that's what's happened and we can't do anything about it. There are a whole set of things in the wine industry that they're already working on, from shading to evaporative cooling, from a whole set of things, because you want to keep it cooler as things are getting warmer. So there's a lot we can do, and that's the point of our project. It's not just to bring you the bad news, but to bring you and start to bring you the strategies and the options that we have if we plan now and start moving that we can get at these things. Here's one other. This was a Pacific Institute study looking at Oakland and looking at social vulnerability in relationship to climate change. So what they've done here is take 19 variables, like how many houses have air conditioning, how many residents are living in institutions, how many are limited English, how many households in poverty, all the various data that you can get to do a social variability index. And then for Oakland, the darkest areas here, that dark kind of reddish brown, that's the highest social vulnerability. The tannish color is the medium, and the yellow would be the least. They're somewhat rough categories. They actually have numbers for every census tract on these things, and you can go census tract by census tract. This is a little bit rough in that they've just done it in thirds. But it gives you a sense of where the highest social vulnerabilities, you know, who has the least tree canopy cover, who has more workers working outdoors, who's going to be more vulnerable to things like heat waves or fires or sea level rise. And then they're starting, and they've done this, and you can see it in the report, to overlay. So here's an overlay of sea level rise with, I think this was with 1.4 meters of sea level rise. You know, again, back here's the map. Here are the more vulnerable populations, and here's where sea level rising. You start to see who's more affected than other populations. Everyone's going to be affected to some degree. So these are just examples, just giving you a couple of things to, we've got lots of great information to work on now from these state reports, and our job is to translate that so that it can be usable by all of us in the policy work. I'll leave you with one final piece. This was the New Yorker cover from the scorching summer that we just had across all of the U.S., except this narrow band for us along the West Coast. And it's really mirrored in the headline from just this last week that the Arctic ice, which has been shrinking as long as we've now been looking at it with satellite measurements since 1979, and it's been shrinking at an accelerated rate in the last decade, it just went down 18% against the record. The record was 2007 for the least amount of sea ice in the Arctic. And we just smash that record by 18%. This is a, you can see kind of the outline there, that outline around, that's the average for the last 30 years, and you can see this year's from the animation that's here. And this is not about sea level rise directly, because this is, again, sea ice. But it's about sea level rise in that it's very close to Greenland, and as you get the Arctic warming a lot more, which it was predicted to warm more than any other part of the globe, and that's happening, you'll get effects on the Greenland ice sheet, which eventually would lead to some significant sea level rise. The other here is that you're going to get changes in weather conditions. You get the jet stream changing. I mean, this is basically, for the Northern Hemisphere, our air conditioner, and it's going. They're looking now at maybe in 4 or 5 years at the low point at the end of the summer, in 4 or 5 years there won't be any sea ice. And 10 years ago they were saying it would take 50 years. So I'll leave you with a quote. from one of the articles on this. While we've long known that the planet warms up, as the planet warms up, changes will be seen first and be most pronounced in the Arctic, but few of us were prepared for how rapidly the changes would actually occur. This is the NSIDC in Boulder that's been working on this now for 30 years. So I leave you again. I bring bad news here, but the good news is we're getting going on preparing, and that's our job. To face these things head on and decide which things here we need to do and which things we need to do statewide and nationwide to prepare ourselves. We have time. We just have to get going. Thank you. That's my report.
Okay, Bruce, thank you, for, I guess, for that report. Mark, and then Mary.
Bruce, can you bring up the, you call it the All-Star list?
Mark, you're right.
There we go. Not that I majored in any of those. Well, actually, letters and science, I guess you could say. And maybe Tom did when he went there. But what I see as missing would be someone. Well, maybe there are some. I say, look.
We have others we're working on.
Okay,
Haas, Goldman. Yeah.
You got some engineers in here?
Engineers, Haas, public health. You know, so this is our list that we started with, and we're going from there.
Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment about, I believe it was slide 7, Bruce, where you had the list of the agricultural products.
Yeah.
The footnote at the bottom alarms me. I don't know how old the data is. It says 2008, mm-hmm. but Contra Costa County has been growing wine grapes for a long time, but we are now bottling it at the local level in eastern Contra Costa County. So,
and drinking it, too.
Yeah, well, we're not counting me in this discussion, John. There's a component missing, I think.
Got it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jake?
Just an anecdote. I have been traveling backwards and forwards to Scotland over the last almost 50 years now, and one of the things that happens to you when you do that on the Great Circle route is you get to look down on Greenland. I flew back this summer and took some photographs, and my anecdote to you is that through my own personal experience, the shrinking of the glaciers, the southern tip of Greenland, the absence of ice in the middle of the summer, these are dramatic. You know, if I was ever a doubting Thomas, I'm no longer a doubting Thomas. This stuff is real.
Scott? Bring your mic, please.
Going back to the slide that has the colors of the viticulture there,
yeah.
You said, I thought I heard you right, but I just want to make sure. You said that's what it could be? Because I'm a little confused because Alameda County has put a lot into planting grapes, and not just grapes, but olives, but intensive ag. So I'm a little... Where do I see the current one?
And I'm sorry for that. The one at the top is the current, okay? And the purple area, which is most of the map for the Bay Area, are the optimal growing conditions. It's actual optimal ripening time for, based on temperature, for the wine industry, for quality wine grapes. And so we're in good shape. The other two are if you run various IPCC warming scenarios, what happens as the Bay Area warms to those optimal conditions.
And what's the date on the slide in the bottom, right?
The two at the bottom are the last 30 years of this century, so it's a ways away, 2070 to 2099.
Okay.
There are changes, and they didn't put this, I wish they'd put this in because I would have used this one. They had a map for 2050, and it's already shifting then with warming. It's more pronounced, obviously, by the end of the century.
I found the presentation very interesting, and I wish you could email it to me, to be honest with you, because I would like to have a copy of it. Great.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else wish to comment? Okay, well, Bruce, thank you. It's pretty sobering to think of the future, and we do need to start thinking about what real steps we can take, maybe baby steps, but we need to take some steps to understand this and also to get strategies to start combating. So with that, let's go to Travis, who's going to fill in for Sean, who's traveling.
I'm actually not going to fill in at all, just to let you know that you got a memo from Sean. He briefed you at the last JPC meeting, and as I noted, they've delayed the rollout of the final report until the ABAG General Assembly on October 18th, so we can move on to the next.
Okay. Well, let me just make a comment. I had an opportunity, I think several of us, Brad had an opportunity, I think Mark, you had an opportunity, maybe not, to be briefed on and have some input into the study. And it was actually extremely interesting and I think helpful. And some of the things that we found were that we've been talking about companies leaving the Bay Area. They're not actually doing that. The data doesn't show that. The data also shows that small business are the drivers. It's the 2, 3, 4 small business that are making driving our economy. But it was really quite interesting. I highly recommend people go to the ABAG presentation on that. That's the 18th, and it's here in Oakland. Is that right, Mark? Okay, great. San Francisco. Where's it going to be?
The Hyatt Regency.
The Hyatt Regency in San Francisco. Okay. All right. Then, Trav, you're going to lead us. Mark, come have a seat here.
First, if anybody wants to speak on any item, if you would please fill out one of the speaker cards and get it back to Fred. Appreciate it. I did want to call to your attention a very brief memo we provided to you entitled Recommendation for Discussion with Senator Mark Desaulniers. With the aim of making this discussion today as productive as possible, we recommend that you should focus on what roles the JPC and the Senator can most productively play in advancing the formulation of an economic development strategy in the Bay region. Senator Desaulniers has stressed the importance of a regional economic strategy by incorporating it into SB 1149, his statement of principles underlying SB 1149, and into SB 878. And at your last meeting, you unanimously decided that Bruce and I, along with the agency staff, should work with the business community to draft an action plan that assesses what elements should be included in a regional economic development strategy, the likely costs of developing such a strategy, and the potential sources of funding for such work. Now, given that both Senator Desaulniers and the JPC are interested in a regional economic development strategy, we believe your discussion today will be most constructive if you focus on this point of agreement. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks. Mark, I don't know. Would you like to make some comments about what your plans are, what your thoughts are relative to moving forward?
As many of you know, I have no plans and I have no thoughts. So, where's Haggerty? No, I just thought. Oh, there he is. I just want to thank you for taking the time. As we discussed some months ago when I met and held 1149, the commitment was to have a discussion on maybe where we could reach agreement. I know talking with some of you, there's been a lot of discussion about how you are working on making the JPC more effective from your own perspective. So in good faith, we held the bill, and we want to work with you. We're from the state, and we're here to help. I will say it, I'm a little tired because I just came in last night. I was in London, St. Petersburg, and Moscow, and I was telling Steve with your counterparts, although in Russia the state in Moscow and St. Petersburg are the same as the regional agencies, and all three of those cities, 85% of their peak trips are by transit, and they still have horrible transportation problems. So imagine if we could get everybody to take transit and get up to 85% and still have the struggles that other large cities have. So just that as an observation, happy to have a discussion about where we go from here.
Well, Mark, let me say that, first of all, we appreciate your coming. I think it's important for you to understand what the JPC is currently doing and what project we're currently involved in. And I know that you had some briefing, but we are obviously, as you heard this morning, deeply involved in the issue of sea level rise, and we're trying to get strategies in place. And we know that as we proceed with this study, that we're inevitably going to try to figure out some ways that we as local government can implement some policies and ideas that we can do ourselves. But inevitably, there's a potential opportunity to go to the state and to go to the state to help clarify some of the local issues or even help us to shape some of the way we move forward. So I think that's something we would like to have you be conscious of and be aware of, and we like to be able to call upon you once we sort of get our act together about what we think is necessary. The other thing is also, the other component is unfortunately Sean is not here, you didn't have an opportunity to hear his briefing, but we are seriously looking and trying to understand the Bay Area economy and trying to figure out what it is that we could do to strengthen our economy and make it stronger for people to continue to grow and prosper in this Bay Area region. And there's also opportunities there. It seems to me that there are opportunities that develop that we could go to you or some other state legislators and say, look, we this is a problem we need to address, and we'd like you to help us at that level. And is that something that you might consider, you know, in terms of kind of waiting for us to get our act together and then trying to figure out what it is that we might be able to do?
I think that's an important point, Tom. And as you know, in the legislative calendar, we're in the interim right now. We start a new two-year session in January. So the point was that we have plenty of time to work with you. Whether there was a bill in the first year, which won't be due until the end of February, or whether we did it in the second year. So if that's your wish. And then one thing I failed to mention, the economic development plan largely came out of a hearing that we had in San Francisco when we were doing the three regional hearings, the State Transportation Committee, about the Bell Bill, AB 47, if memory serves me. And we talked about particularly Seattle and Puget Sound and how they've done an economic development plan there, and it's worked and integrated with their RTP and their equivalent of a state implementation plan. So you know, there are plenty of models out there, as I've said, and that's sort of the result. And also your discussions and your interest, Tom, on an economic development plan. And I know the Bay Area Council and the Silicon Leadership Group as well. So I think the timing's good. I really would prefer to work with you rather than have us fighting amongst one another. So that's the point of being here. And the more I can be educated as to what you're doing, the better, so we can work collaboratively.
Okay. Well, that's reassuring. Does anyone want to make some comments, please? I guess the meeting's over. No. Well, Mark, I think that, you know, we have to do some trust building. I think that was one of the problems we encountered in the last session, was that we felt, I'm figuring out from the JPC's point of view, we felt that we weren't really consulted about the legislative package, and we felt that we weren't really, you know, involved in helping shape it. It was just, we sort of came down, and then there it was. And we would like to avoid that kind of situation if we can. By actually agreeing to work together and trying to figure out what, you know, we are going to come with some ideas. You may not want to embrace them all, but the ones that you can, we would like to work on a positive basis.
I've got plenty of other things I can do. Now, and my interest, as some of you know, who I was privileged to serve with on these boards and committees, is just the belief that in a global economy, people live regionally. And, you know, part of the reason for the trip I just took is because I have an interest in it and I've traveled to other parts of the world. And the average citizen in a global economy lives regionally more than they do based on state and even country boundaries anymore. So the more, I just think it's on the natural, we're going to switch to more regional governance. People, you know, work and cross city and county jurisdictions all the time. So that the being somewhat parochial and being very proud, and I know you all share this, representing this amazing region, the more we can be in front of that and being innovative, and we have been in many cases, the better.
Miriam.
Just to mention that in addition to the efforts that we're putting through the Bay Area Council, there are two other parallel integrated efforts towards economic development strategies. One is the HUD grant that we received, and we're working very closely with local jurisdictions, with labor councils, with workforce training constituencies to identify what are the strategic areas where the region can support specific economic development. That is tied to some of the work that we're also doing at ABAC in identifying what we're calling places of opportunity and industries of opportunity. We enjoy a certain economic wealth in the region, but we're very aware that that is changing, and how that is changing in the large cities, in terms of the office park, in terms of the industrial land, and the small city is something that needs careful attention, and we're working towards getting more specificity in the way we want to frame our investments so that we can support the economic health that we have enjoyed.
Adrian, and then Mark.
Just a quick question. You know, Senator, you were talking about your sort of the regional vision, and you've been traveling all over. I wonder if you could give us any little framework or areas of concern that really stand out to you as you've moved about the countries and seen things done differently than we do here, or better or worse than we're doing here.
Well, you know, the one thing I think, and just in context of the previous speaker, all of these cities, Hong Kong, London, Beijing, they see there are competitors, as the business community knows and you know. Our ability to have workforce housing and transportation infrastructure that is not negatively impacted, they see they're trying to do the same thing to, if possible, take some of our entrepreneurial advantages away from us because it's a competitive global marketplace. So to the degree that we do that, I think that's really a good thing. To the degree that we've worked together, particularly the One Voice, you know, for years when Larry was here, and Steve's done a great job with that, of going back to D.C. in particular with One Voice is really helpful. That's one thing I think other regions in the world don't do as well, but they're catching up. So I think that's really the most important thing, is how we as public representatives in a global workforce, a global economy, make sure that we have infrastructure that helps keep and retain the businesses we have, but also attract more. And I was always, you know, until the last 10, 15 years, I never really thought it that way until literally the first time I went to London, and the London transportation people said, we're competing with you. We always competed with New York, and now we look at competing with San Francisco and other regions to attract your businesses away from where they are. So I think that's the biggest thing. I think it's just a social model. The social model has a tendency in the business model to be ahead of democracy and public sector sort of response to how we support that, and I think we're just in one of those periods where we're trying to keep up with it.
And maybe just one follow-up. You know, we had a lot of meetings on this Plan Bay Area where we're trying to do just that, workforce housing and transit, and we really got a tremendous amount of pushback from some of the outlying communities, and I guess the question I'd have for you is, do you have any suggestions on how we could sort of influence individuals that, you know, it isn't just about me and my car and my house. It is about the global economy. And it was pretty startling to get that kind of pushback when we all know that if we stay stagnant, we're really not going to grow economically either. So, you know, that's a big hurdle we're facing as we just keep moving this Plan Bay Area forward.
You know, all of you are local government folks. I was in local government. I may be again. Oh, that's not a threat to my two colleagues. I won't come back. I'll tell Karen you said that. You know, there's always going to be something like that. When I was in Russia, they were talking about the opposition of their high-speed rail project from St. Petersburg and Moscow, where the opponents put giant snowmen out on the right-of-way trying to stop it. So I think it's just the nature. My response was, the more we do outreach, the better we bring people in and bring people who understand the vision in.
Yeah. Mark.
There we go. Senator, I'm going to get back to the economic part. You know, Mary and I both sit on the East Bay Economic Development Alliance, and, you know, Tom and I, as and Julie, were over at the San Francisco launching of the plans, which will be fully developed on the 18th of next month. And, you know, we're hearing all the time about, you know, the Bay Area. Most of the business here is created by either businesses being established or growing. It isn't this sniping of moving a business from Concord to San Ramon or San Carlos to San Mateo or Hayward to Fremont that's really not doing anything for any of us in a larger context. And it's that we need to be really establishing this area as the most inviting areas we possibly can for new businesses to, A, be established here, and then, B, when they're successful, to stay here. Those are the two biggest thrusts. And this whole area of, you know, regulatory reform, you know, keeping an educated workforce, making it even more educated for and workforce development, infrastructure, you know, you mentioned housing. The Silicon Valley Leadership Group, every year for like the last decade, has said that's their biggest concern, housing, how it's consistent. And I'm wondering, you know, from your standpoint, if you're thinking that a regional authority or a regional exemption for the Bay Area, or the power for the Bay Area to do this in terms of coordinating, or is it going to be more of a statewide effort, which we're part of in a larger standpoint from the state of California? Or are you going to be looking at something where the Bay Area could be carved out as a leader or a on the cutting edge of something in terms of truly regional cooperation on the economic front, as well as all the other things which build into creating a good economic environment?
And that's the spirit, really, of today, is we have enough time to develop. You do a legislative action plan every year. Now's a good time to do that. I don't think with what we just did with redevelopment and the consequences for the housing set aside, personally, as chair of the Transportation and Housing Committee, we need to totally revamp how we approach housing and affordability in the state. We can't do it without that setting set aside. I had a bill that would have established a fee that some of you probably are aware of on real estate transactions that the realtors actually supported, but I needed 27 votes to get out of the Senate. I had all the Democrats vote for it, but I couldn't get two Republicans. So that was a significant amount of money for all of you to do infill housing in your redevelopment areas. We don't have that anymore. So we're still going to ask you to do your arena numbers, all those wonderful meetings I remember in this room. Clearly, we have to address housing law and the arena allocations, given the fact that we're not giving much financial support anymore. So that's something we could work on sort of separate, but also with us.
John?
Mark, I appreciate, you know, your focus on the issue of economic strategy. I know something that we're working on, and I think it touches on Adrian's comment, which is, you know, even in the work that we do, sort of we're caught in the middle of trying to come up with comprehensive thinking and planning for the region with, you know, communities in the region looking at us in a very suspect way, saying this is taking control of local government. But yet we're also trying to balance with sort of what you've observed, which is we are competing with other metropolitan urban areas around the world. So I think maybe going forward, thinking about how either through legislation or some other means and help from the state, we're able to sort of balance that issue of getting buy-in, as Adrian says, from folks around the region to achieve really what are these goals to compete internationally. And I think one of the items, on the agenda later, is in which we're going to talk about, is developing a sea level rise strategy, which, frankly, I think makes us stronger economically, because if we come up with a plan for the region, we're able to grow the economy more and compete with other parts of the world. So, for one, I appreciate that you're putting this in the perspective of not just what's happening here in the United States, but what's happening around the world, because the Bay Area does have to compete. And our message is, how do we get our constituents around the Bay Area to understand that this is just as much about making the region stronger as it is about, you know, trying to deal with local land use issues? I think it's easy to get focused in our parochial way of, you know, we've got to work on local land use, we've got to meet the requirements, you know, of the develop a sustainable communities strategy, but it's ultimately about how the Bay Area is positioned to compete around the world. And I know we all get that, but that's sort of the dilemma we're in, is bringing along our constituents, and that's why I think the leadership here is really important to do that.
Mark?
Thank you. I apologize to everybody for being late. I had a re-election debate taping this morning, and I tried to explain what JPC was, but they cut me off. Anyway, Mark, there's a...
that was a good strategy.
Yeah. Mark, there's a bill up in... and thanks for being here. There's a bill up in the Senate or the Assembly regarding SB 375 to replace redevelopment, to allow housing around transit. Are you aware of that? And could you fill
Senator Steinberg has a bill on the governor's desk right now, and I can't remember the number of it.
Has
do you know the details of it?
No, it's on the governor's desk. So it's Senator Steinberg's bill, I think you're referring to. It's sort of a follow-up to redevelopment with a 375 influence, and Tom Adams from the California League of Conservation Voters, who was very instrumental in 375, was very instrumental in whatever that bill number is. I can never remember all the bill numbers. So it's on the governor's desk.
Do we know what that does? Is anybody familiar with that bill and content of it?
From what I understand, it had to do with housing around
Transit-oriented development.
Transit-oriented development. And it was similar to tax increment financing.
Yes, it allows for tax increment financing around TOD.
So it's similar to the bill that Lonnie carried then, implementing.
Everything good up there is similar to what Senator Hancock does.
That's right.
I don't know where she gets her ideas.
Alcohol. The wine industry. Okay. Anybody else want to make say yes, Mary?
Mr. Bates, just to clarify, it's SB 1156, Sustainable Communities Investment Authority, and I've got a little bit of information if you want it.
Yeah, I think that would be actually important to. So, anyone else want to make some comments to the senator? This is a.
You're all being so nice.
Okay. Well, Mark, let me just say. Well, first of all, we really appreciate your being here. Second of all, we have gone through, this organization has gone through some growing and actually defining of our mission and the way we want to make decisions. And how we're proceeding in the future, and we are seriously looking. And if you have an opportunity to stay, seriously trying to figure out what we can do about the sea level rise. And it's highly possible that out of this, our understanding of what we could do, that we would be calling upon you to help us figure out some of these things, because some of these issues are much broader than we can deal with as local government. So there are situations where we also would love to, so there's that one hand, so getting some specific ideas that we could come to you and others to try to implement around sea level rise. And we're not prepared today to say what those are, but we want to discuss it, we want to think about it, we want to come forward. If, you know, it's a question of what we come up with and how viable it is, but we'd like to have more discussion with you about that. Well, and the other thing I want to mention is the issue of the economic, trying to understand the regional economy. It would be extremely helpful. I know this is it's not too feasible, but it would be extremely helpful if there was some way we could get some kind of state resources, money, to help us do some of the planning and some of the work that's needed to be done, because there's no place to get it. So if there's any kind of opportunity for some kind of arrangement for us to get a fee or some kind of way to get some way to get some money to be able to actually do the work that's necessary to get it done.
Okay. Happy to do that. I was just going to suggest maybe we could figure out a way so we're not reacting to one another or appear to be reacting to one another. Rich Gordon and I are co-chairs of the Bay Area Legislative Caucus with the idea that there'd be one assembly member and one senator co-chairing, and then one from the West Bay and one from the East Bay. So perhaps we can work with that group and with this group to make sure we're better coordinated on how we roll out legislation and what we're thinking about, what you would like from us.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. So why don't we leave it like that? We'll try to get our act together, and then we'll come and see if we have those discussions. And we appreciate your coming, and we would hope that in the future we'd have continue to have a positive relationship. We had a little rocky one there for a while, but we all want it to be positive. We all want it to work together, because we're all in this together. I mean, we're all one region, and we all want to see us prosper and grow. And so we'd like to realize that that's where we're coming from, a position of being positive. And we hope that we can work positively together in the future.
Every marriage has its rocky moments.
That's right. Okay.
Since I've been divorced for 20 years.
We're not divorced. We're not even doing a trial separation.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Mark. Okay. So we now go to the next item we got on the agenda, which is going to be the report. I guess it's going to be Bruce again, right?
Before we turn to the 24-page report Bruce and I have prepared, we thought it would be helpful for you to hear a short presentation from an expert on flood protection as to why we should begin paying more attention to flood risks now. We talk about sea level rise in the future, but I think looking at some of the dangers we're facing now will be helpful to you. That expert is Jeremy Lowe, and he is the Sea Level Rise Program Manager at the consulting firm of ESA PWA. He is a coastal geomorphologist who has detailed knowledge of estuarine systems, process modeling, and coastal engineering. His 14 years of international experience spans a wide range of projects in the United Kingdom, Italy, Lebanon, Hong Kong, and the United States, and his achievements include the design of sea defenses to reduce flood hazards in Venice, Italy, coastal erosion protection for the new Hong Kong airport, and policy recommendations to the United Kingdom on intertidal habitat restoration. Jeremy, take it away.
Well, thank you. And what I was going to show you was not just the projections of mean sea level rise that have been thought through by the state and by the by international scientific communities. We've seen a lot of those, and if we press the first button, we'll see, firstly, the sea level rise here, showing the number of years from 1890 through to 2100 on the bottom of the scale, and on the side we've got the rise in inches. We've got 7 inches of sea level rise. So we've experienced that in the bay. We then press it again, and these are the projections that we have for mean sea level rise. This is when everything is calm in the bay, nothing is moving around, and we can see we're expecting to see about 14 or 16 inches of sea level rise by 2050. By the end of the century, it could be between 40, 55 inches. Press the button again. And this is the federal high rate of sea level rise there that we're using for planning in the bay, which is about 58 inches of sea level rise. So it's significant amounts of sea level rise. And when we talk about that, we're asked, you know, what's the sea level rise going to be in 2050, 2070?
Oh,
what's the sea level rise going to be in 2050, 2070? It's very difficult. We have a range. There's all these projections, as Bruce has pointed out earlier on. There's a number of different numbers we can give you for a particular date. However, if we think about the data in a slightly different way and think about the elevation at which we have constructed our infrastructure, that we constructed our levees, that we constructed our flood defences, we press the button again, there we can see that quite a few of these elevations are going to be passed in a relatively short period of time. In a period of about 10 years or so, we're expecting to see maybe a changes of 20, the elevation passing 25 inches of sea level rise. And so given that our infrastructure is being built for a 50-year period of life or 70 years or so, we should be thinking about the vulnerability of our existing infrastructure in terms of its elevation. And then when is it going to get wet in the future? And rather than just looking at the mean sea level rise, we should be looking at extreme events. Now, this is an extreme event in New Year's Eve 2005, and I'm sure lots of people remember that period. There was a lot of flooding around the bay. This is on the East Bay by Hayward, and it shows a high water level. There's a storm surge. The wind is blowing across the bay, pushing up waves. And accompanied with the high tide. And you can see here the existing levee is being overtopped. Water's going over the top of the levee. It's going behind it. It's flooding that area. Luckily, that was mainly an existing salt pond area. There were no houses there. But it's indicative of the power of the extreme event that we have in the bay. And, of course, when the water went down, there was damage down to the levee, and that maintenance had to be improved. So we go to the next slide. So the next slide, again, now we're looking again at the a graph showing the change of sea level over time. We've got on the bottom, we've got from 1890 to 2100. On the side, we've got the rise in sea level in inches. And at the bottom, I put that graph of the mean sea level rise. But now I've added in a number of all these little crosses, these cloud of crosses, which show the maximum sea level that was recorded in the bay each year from 1890 to 2010. And you can see that's significantly higher. And also you can see there's a trend in the annual maximums. They're increasing. And so what we do when we think about flood risk management, we think about, well, what's the elevation we're going to get once every 50 years or so? What's the elevation we're going to get once every 10 years? What's the elevation we're going to get once every year? We try and think of it in terms of a risk, in terms of how often are we going to see these extreme sea levels. And so what I can do here now, as you press the button, is that we have...
I want to make sure I'm looking at that correctly. In addition to the slight increase, it looks darker on the right, which tells me there's actually more of those events as well. Is that... Or am I not reading that correctly? There seem to be more events in more recent years, more of these maximum events, is that just the effect I'm seeing of that slide?
I think that might be the effect that there should be one per year. But what you are seeing is that you are correct in seeing that general trend. I think you're also seeing the lower. We're not getting so many low maximums. We're getting a lot higher maximums.
Right.
And I think that is related to what I've tried to do here is show these lines here showing what the return periods for 1 month, the 2 month, the 1 year, 50 year, and so on. So as the events get rarer, they get higher. And what we can see here is in the past the bay was relatively stable, the sea levels were relatively predictable, and we can design our sea level our flood defense structures to with some certainty about what they should look like over the next 50 years. However, with sea level rise, you can see all of these curves are bending upwards. What we're going to experience is more frequent, higher events, which are going to cause more damage, and we're going to have to do something in relation to our flood risk management, and we're going to do something with what development is behind those levees. So we press the next button. For example, this red line illustrates a level of a defense. And what was, and we press again the button. And what was acceptable in the 1950s is a 50-year return period. So once every 50 years, we might get wet, might interrupt production, it might interrupt, cause some damage, but we have a period to respond to. By 2020, obviously the elevation of the structure stays the same, but by 2020, that extreme period then becomes a 1 in 10 event. And then by 2045, we're down to 1 in 1 year. And then by 2070, it's every month. Now, our flood risk management accepts some possibilities of damage, and we have insurance for that. What does happen is this becomes a more recurring event, interrupting the normal daily lives that we have around the bay, and it interrupts that economic production in the area. Next slide. And so this is also, you can plot this out spatially, and this has been done by the MTC and the BCDC project, which is adapting to rising tides. And this shows placing those extreme events on a map showing the areas that could be inundated. And here we've got a map between the Bay Bridge down to the San Mateo Bridge, and it shows the extensive areas now that could be flooded on extreme events, and it also shows the depth. The darker the blue, the deeper the water. And that's generally translated in the darker the deeper the water, the more the cost of the damage. So we can see that even now there is potential for damage that we have in these areas, and that potential is going to increase much more rapidly than the mean sea level rise impacts could be plotted. Next slide. So we have a number of drivers around the bay, and we talked about sea level rise, and I put sea level rise and the storminess, the waves, and so on. But it's not just the water going over the levee from the bay that we should be worrying about. Press button. So what we then have, we also, with climate change, we're expecting to see increasing rainfall. We're expecting to see runoff increasing, and those more swollen creeks and sloughs feeding into the bay, taking our stormwater off the site. We're going to have more trouble getting that stormwater onto the bay because the bay has risen in elevation and the gravity is no longer allowing us to get the water out. We're going to have drainage problems. Next slide. We're also going to see changes in the bay. Our wetlands, that great ecosystem values that we have in the bay, and we've done a lot of restoration on those, they're also going to be adapting to sea level rise. So we're going to see some changes in there we have to contend with. We also know we have land subsidence, we have tectonic movements, we have groundwater extraction. So we have to think about how all these different elements are changing, because they're going to affect the next piece, which is firstly our level of protection that our existing levees provide. So they're fixed in place. They were designed for certain conditions. All those conditions are starting to change, and we need to think about how we can reduce the frequency at which we're going to get flooded. More frequent flooding, more extreme flooding. And then the second thing we're going to have to think about is that we have obviously built right up against the bay, edge of the bay. We've built a levee system to protect that, but that development's not going to stop. That's going to carry on. So the consequences of flooding are going to increase over time. So the combination of increased frequency and increased consequences increases the risk that we face. And so we need to think about, in the long term, the strategies that will reduce risk to allow the bay to be to us to use the bay as we do in the at the moment, but also to think about how we can accommodate it in reducing the risk. Next slide. And so we finish with an example. This is, again, New Year's Eve 2005, and if people have been to Martinez, you'd recognize the main street looking down from Castro, and this was the flooding that we had in that area. And the flooding in that area, Alhambra Creek, is a combination not just of water coming off the land, but it's also related to the bay elevations that we have. And the higher the bay elevations we have, the more difficult it is to get the water off out into the bay. And of course, Martinez sits right on the bay, and if the water doesn't get through, it stays there. Next,
yeah, we had a 7-foot tide at that point, so the water can't.
So
go
I'm
out.
Just going to show, yeah. to show exactly your point that this is the last graph, and it just shows a period about 5 or 6 days here, showing the green line at the bottom is the predicted astronomical tide we expected to see in Benicia, and so as the green line goes up and down, then the sun and the moon are interacting, and they're driving that. So that's very predictable. But on top of that, we had this intense precipitation, a lot of runoff, and that's the red line was the measured line at D Street of the peak flows down the right. And what we had was a coincidence of the bay elevation and the red line. And what we're going to see in the future, firstly, all those elevations are going to increase, but if we're unlucky and we get the coming together of a very high tide and a very intense rainstorm, both things which are projected to happen more frequently in the future, then events such as that we saw at Martinez are going to become more common, and strategies to avoid those will have to be start thinking how to put those into place.
Questions? Yes, Gregory. Jeffrey, I'm sorry. Okay, never read.
Could we return to the slide that had the red line and the various incidences of high water?
Yeah, I think it's the third slide.
Yeah, that one. So if I understand it correctly, the red line was the level of protection against sea rise that was put in earlier days to protect against basically once every 50-year events.
Yeah, I took a generic view. I mean, this is just a place, and this is an example of the elevation.
And the series of dots represent the high water mark for in any given year, and they're increasing and getting closer to the protection, basically.
Yes.
And you're projecting that as we go out, it will be then once every 10 years, then once every year, and then once a month, basically.
That's correct, okay. Yes.
So my agency is the Bay Conservation Development Commission. We spent a lot of time over the past couple of years dealing with sea level rise. We've probably seen hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of exhibits and testimony, et cetera. And this single graph, I think, explains it and poses the threat possibly better than anything I've ever seen. So I just want to recommend that it be part of what we do going forward, because clearly there is a level of protection that protects all of us here in the Bay Area, and the phenomena that is occurring are threatening that, and it is a wall that protects us, and it's getting closer and closer, and it's going to happen with more frequency, and that puts it better than most anything I've seen. So, thank you.
So, you know, we in my community in Berkeley, where we have all the Berkeley Hills, and when they have the rains, heavy rains, the rains come down and they come to the bay, and then we have a place where we hold an aquatic park, which is there. And what happens exactly what's being described, the tide rises and we can't get the water in, and so then it starts backing up, and we have a flooding problem in West Berkeley, and it's like, I don't know what you do about it. I mean, so what are the strategies we can put in place to overcome these situations?
So one of the obvious strategies is to look at the existing way we do things, which is we do detain a lot of water up in the watersheds. We do route it. There are increasing those detentions might be a way to do it. Increasing the detentions for a short period of time, because the tide goes up, but it also comes down on a regular basis. If we can provide sufficient storage, and then we may have to pump it over the levee, that's another issue that we might have. There's issues that we have of constraining the stormwater channels across our marshes. Are there ways that we can open those up? And that goes hand in hand with water quality benefits that we might get from that and from ecosystem restoration benefits as well. So there's a number of win-win situations that are being explored. It's more that part of that is not just one agency or one city coming up with a solution. These are more of a regional shoreline, maybe 3 or 4 miles of shoreline, having to work together because they're all going to be subject to the same types of risk changes in the future.
That's a very good point. Scott?
If you could go back to the slide that showed the blues, the different level of blues in the water on the Bay Area. There was a slide, the map, yeah, right there, yeah, the art project, I guess. You know, to me it seems like, I'm trying to figure out, I'm assuming that one area up on the top is the Oakland Airport area, and then I'm assuming the area on the bottom is San Jose El Viso, is that correct?
No, it's the
area between the Dumbarton.
Okay, so I'm really having a hard time seeing today. Is that the Oakland area?
This is the Oakland Airport here, where the... There.
Right. Where do we get to San Jose or no?
And no. We get to San Mateo Bridge.
Okay. The Alameda Flood Control Channel.
Okay. Well, let me throw my comment more towards Oakland then, because I'm really trying to struggle to see this, and I'm sure that the map looking down at San Jose and El Viso is probably not. It's probably really blue too, to be very honest with you, and we don't have the advantage of seeing San Francisco either, and I have no idea what happens in San Francisco. I would assume the airport, which is about this much above the water right now, is gone, and some other problems. What I'm getting at is we're working right now through One Bay Area, and really the strategy of the One Bay Area is to push everything more into the urban core, invest the transportation dollars there and all that. What is the sense of that? I mean, we sit here, we talk about sea level rise, and then we go to other meetings where we talk about, you know, we really need to push more infrastructure into these areas. And so I'm struggling as a policymaker. How does this all come together? Because it seems like there is a disconnect between what's happening with sea level rise and then what's happening with One Bay Area over at MTC and ABAC. And I could be off on this, but to me, intuitively, that's what it seems like.
Well, as we get into the recommendation in a little bit, what we're talking about is essentially walking and chewing gum at the same time. We do want to be working through the sustainable community strategy to be encouraging more infill around transit, and a lot of that is in low-lying areas around the bay, as you pointed out. So we can't ignore sea level rise, nor can we allow a defeatist strategy to say we ought to abandon our sustainable community strategy. So what we need to be doing is integrating the two together into one strategy that is looking at achieving both objectives. And we think it is possible to do that with a regional sea level rise strategy, and the work plan we're giving you integrates that into the sustainable community strategy.
I guess I'll wait to see that, but again, and I know there's people that have been looking and working on this certainly much longer than me. But it seems like, and I guess your strategy is not, but at some point, maybe there should be some sort of a retreat type strategy too. And maybe not just saying, look, you're blue, get the heck out. You know, we're going to let you go underwater. I know that's not the direction people want to go. But it seems like there are some areas in which we're not going to be able to save, and we may have to just say, sorry, you know, and we need to retreat from this area.
You are exactly right, but the choice should not be between, as Steve Golbeck always says, between fight or flight. It's not building levees everywhere, and it is not retreating to the hills everywhere. It is taking a very nuanced approach, as we've been doing with the sustainable community strategy, working with the local governments, determining where it is appropriate to focus on wetland restoration and where it is appropriate to be doing flood control and flood protection. And you can do both, but you can't do it at a local government by local government level, because if you do that and one local government takes one approach and the other one takes another approach, you're going to have the water coming around the back. So that is what we're going to be recommending to you in a few minutes.
Okay, Mark, and then I think it was public comment, so I think I'll go to some public comments and then come back to the JPC. Mark.
Okay, thank you. There are two parts, Jeremy. I guess what I'm blaming is the incidence of major rainfall events, maybe not from your presentation, but in Martinez we found out that it's the tide is one element. The amount of rain over 7 days, if it's 3 inches over 7 days, the hills get so saturated that there's a noticeable increase in the runoff. So when we get these major events, instead of steady rain, we're getting major events and increased saturation. Is that the trend we're seeing?
Oh, yes. And as I mentioned, in the climate change projections, the projections for the storm, the precipitation, the rainfall storms, we're going to expect to see those increasing in intensity as well. So the issue of more runoff from the urban areas is going to increase as well. So you're correct in that point.
Okay. And second is, and this is more towards a Contra Costa concern, is saltwater intrusion. As you know, the Contra Costa takes its water out of the delta. Really haven't talked about how much that intrusion may affect Contra Costa, but also when I see that lowlands along the East Bay, is there going to be saltwater intrusion possibilities into the water tables, and how would that affect Silicon Valley too?
Well, certainly in the delta, with increased sea level rise, we're going to see there. We're going to see more saline water coming into the delta, which may affect the water supply and the extractions from there. We're expecting to see the wetlands along the Carquinez Straits changing from being a brackish type of wetland to a more saline one, and we're expecting to see the salinity in general in that area to change. So you're going to see changes in the water body itself. You're also going to see changes in groundwater elevations, which goes to the more into the South Bay, where we're expecting to see not just sea level rise changing, but the water levels below ground changing as well. And that is not something we necessarily design for in our facilities and with our groundwater extractions.
That groundwater become more saline and not potable?
It depends on whereabouts you are, but that is something that people are very interested in, and about how, particularly in the South Bay, understanding those movements and how they may be affected. But it's very early days for that type of modeling.
Great. I really appreciate this presentation because, you know, you always think about sea level rise as saying, well, that's going to happen. You know, it's going to be an inch here or an inch two there, you know, and it's going to be 100 years, and I'm not going to be around, and none of my relatives are going to be around. But these extreme weather conditions are here right now, and I think people can really understand that. And so we need to make strategies right now. We can't wait, say, you know, somewhere or other, because the sea level is going to rise a few inches in a few years, that we don't have to worry. I mean, it's here and right now. David, do you want to make a comment?
Just kind of a question, and for some reason it was triggered by Commissioner Haggerty's question. Will the urban sim modeling somehow be integrated with this analysis? You know, going back to this, it's not all fight or flight. I'm, you know, if you're going to have a nuanced response to the problem, you know, along iterations of cosine, it seems to me that modeling work is a resource. I was looking in the report in terms of where a resource is going to come from, and it seems like that's an available one for plugging in some of the issues.
I'm going to turn to the staff of MTC and ABAG to answer that.
My suspicion, Commissioner, is that it isn't presently, but could be in the future. And maybe just to chip in on the point, remember this flight idea. I get awfully nervous when we talk about that at all, because the Nimitz Freeway can't flee. The BART system can't flee. And we've got a whole lot of people living there now. And I think we've got probably a pretty strong duty to protect them, much less the new neighbors we want to bring to them with the sustainable community strategy. So I think, although we got to talk about both ideas, at least in my own head, and given what's out there, the facts on the ground, the presumption very heavily tilts toward protection. And that, to me, back to Commissioner Haggerty's question, is all the more reason that if you have that obligation and you're going to have that expense to protect, then the SCS makes a whole lot of sense because you've got to protect that area anyway. So let's get more folks in it.
And that is where my thinking was going in terms of even dealing with what I know about Albizu in the South Bay, which is right in the middle of my political district, and we're doing a lot of work out there. There's a master plan that hasn't been developed yet at all, adopted but not developed or implemented. So, you know, whether it's at the local level or the regional level, clearly it seems like it would make sense to model what's going to happen once you actually do that development, build that out, and now build in these levels of protection that you need that weren't considered 10 years ago when the master plan was adopted by the city council. So somehow that has to be done. It just seemed to me that urban SIM is rather than coming up with a new modeling program, software, or tool, it would make sense, given who we are as JPC, to take advantage of that work. That's
yeah, I think you're probably suggesting maybe another item in the work program for what Trav is about to present us, which is the data and the analysis that we develop for this need to feed into our existing analytical tools.
Exactly.
I think that's right. So, you know, actually, I'm going to go to Travis for the hold off the public so they can at least hear what the recommendation is, and we'll hear from the public, then we'll bring back to discussion after we hear the recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We provided you with a report which explains in some detail why we're recommending that the JPC should take on a leadership role in the formulation of a regional sea level rise adaptation strategy. This recommendation was endorsed by the agency executive directors on September 5th, and your executive committee considered it on September 10th. And although we were one person short of a quorum that we needed for official action by the executive committee, all the members that were present supported the recommendation. Now, this report stems from an action taken nearly a year ago when BCDC amended the San Francisco Bay Plan to address climate change. In addition to revising its regulatory policies that apply to shoreline development, BCDC recommended that the JPC should oversee the formulation of a regional sea level rise adaptation strategy. The agency executive directors endorsed BCDC's recommendation last November, and you took up the matter in December. You referred it back to each of the regional agencies. And in January of this year, you decided not to make a decision on sea level rise until you could come up with a more systematic process for dealing with this question and other regional issues. As you know, between February and May, Bruce and I undertook an extensive reassessment of the JPC's purpose and processes, and you adopted a detailed series of policies, procedures, and decisions to guide your deliberations. And that body of guidance is contained in Attachment A of this report that is before you today. By applying this guidance, you're now in a position to decide what role you should take in dealing with sea level rise. And in our report, we've carefully applied the six criteria you adopted for determining whether you should take a lead on a regional issue. And according to each of these criteria, we've concluded that the JPC's leadership on sea level rise adaptation is both appropriate and needed. The procedures you've adopted prescribe that if you decide to take on a regional leadership role on a particular issue, the agency staff will then develop a work plan for carrying out that leadership role. But given the likelihood that preparing a sea level rise strategy will take some years and be quite costly, the agency executive directors asked the staffs of ABAG and BCDC to take the lead in formulating a work plan in advance of your decision. And that detailed work plan is contained in Attachment B of our report. As I mentioned, it calls for integrating sea level rise adaptation into the sustainable community strategy. Now, this whole effort could take as long as 10 years to complete and could cost $20 million. As explained in the report, given the success that the agency staff have had in securing funds for climate adaptation planning to date, it's quite possible that the needed $2 million a year would be available through a combination of federal grants, state bond funds, partnerships, foundations, and JPC agency budgets. But if you adopt this recommendation today, a more detailed fundraising strategy should be developed. Now, fortunately, we don't have to do this immediately because funding is already in place to complete the work called for in the first task of the work plan. We've also laid the groundwork to qualify for state bond funding. We're exploring foundation support for some of the work. And as recommended in the work plan, we would work very closely with the Coastal Conservancy because they have control over some funding needed for adaptation. Also, the procedures you have adopted call for developing a work plan, as I said, after you decide to take a regional leadership issue up. In this case, you have the work plan, which includes an initial assessment of funding opportunities before you make your decision. Therefore, we believe you have enough information available to you today to make a decision. Using your adopted policies and procedures, we've concluded that the JPC should take on a leadership role in facilitating the formulation of a regional sea level rise adaptation strategy. You should fulfill this facilitation role through your responsibilities for regional leadership and regional agency coordination. And as I mentioned at the outset, the agency executive directors and your executive committee support our conclusion and recommendation. Also, as the strategy is developed, it should be developed in partnership with the local agencies that are responsible for flood protection. That concludes my report. I'm available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will, can you give me some of the history? Because I know that BCDC started originally to take this on, and can you just give me a history of what happened at BCDC? I know it became somewhat of a hot potato. And it's not, I just want history. I just, knowledge is power, so I want to know what it is. I'm supportive of this.
Okay, very.
And I see the need for all the agencies to be sitting around the table.
Very quickly, in capsule version, BCDC prepared maps showing what sea level rise could mean to the Bay Area by 2050 and 2100. We thought at BCDC that preparing those maps would open a regional dialogue as to what we do about the problem. The mistake we made was not realizing that the messenger is as important as the message. And because BCDC was a regulatory agency, there was a great deal of concern expressed that the maps were not representing what sea level rise would do so much as what BCDC wanted to do in terms of expanding its regulatory authority. We therefore decided that the most prudent thing to do would be to have a body that was not a regulatory agency but rather was a coordinating body, that is the JPC, take the leadership role. So BCDC changed its policies that apply to development along the shoreline and also recommended that the JPC should take on the leadership role. Some people have described that as tossing a hot potato to somebody else. Others have described it as a reasonable response to the concerns that were expressed.
Well, I certainly believe it makes sense for everybody, at least sitting around this table, to be involved in the solution. So I see the merit. I just kind of wanted to get the history of what was going on at BCDC, because to me it does seem it's really appropriate that they're involved and they're here at the table, so that's a good thing.
Well, it's also very important, as Mr. Heminger pointed out, there's a lot of transportation infrastructure that's in danger of flooding from sea level rise. So MTC has to be at the table. You have to have the local governments at the table. So it's absolutely essential that ABAG be involved. BCDC has developed this body of expertise. They should be involved. And at the same time we're doing this, walking and chewing gum at the same time and maybe tipping our hat up and down, we also have to be looking at the implications of air quality on those decisions. So you have here the four agencies under the guidance of the JPC. This is the perfect, appropriate
and proper place to take on this issue.
What about, do you think that this agency, and maybe this is a reason why all four of us should merge, but do you think we then bring on baggage from, I mean, I remember what was going on maybe about a year ago, I think, is pretty ugly. And so do you think because we're taking this up as this group now, we become the dartboard?
I don't believe so. Again, the JPC is a coordinating body, and you should fulfill your role in coordinating and providing regional leadership on this issue. Will it be easy? No. Will it be controversial? Yes. Does it have to be done? Absolutely. And we keep coming back to the issue that was raised earlier. Sea level rise and climate change, at the end of the day, are not environmental issues. They are economic imperative. Let's look at what happens if we don't do this. And that's where I think it becomes, you come to the obvious conclusion. If we want our region to remain prosperous, we have to have a strategy for dealing with this problem that's been tossed at us.
Okay, we have three people from the public, and then we'll go back to the members of the commission. Rich Hedges, Carol Maloney, and Alex Lemner.
Good morning, Rich Hedges. This is really a great discussion. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. I had a couple of questions. I've been listening to this debate for some time, watching the debate at BCDC about sea rise. And I was wondering if there's been any thought about the amount of silting in the Bay Area, because in some ways it is a flood reservoir. I live on a flood channel, and silting is actually an issue because the volume of water that you can contain in a large runoff diminishes with silting. And I know with all of the construction down valley that we've had in the last 20 years and the changes in the way we're getting rainfall now has to create more erosion. Just does. So that's the question, if we've given a thought to what silting is going to do to the rise of sea level in the Bay Area. And there were earlier some discussion about reaction to development. I'm beginning to get positive on that. I was very involved in the Bay Meadows fight, and at some point you just have to go forward. And our city council was very, very good about putting re-election and politics aside to do the right thing. But they work with the community strongly. So at some point, when you know you're doing the right thing, you just have to move. And about the levees, I was very involved, as well as Marshall Loring, in repairing the levees in San Mateo. We actually, in 2005, during the storm you were talking about, I was down watching San Mateo Creek during the rainstorm. It was a period of time where we'd had a drought the year before. Crystal Springs had not been allowed to run freely and during the rainstorm, so they had to release the water. We had this big, heavy storm, and quite frankly, there was something that occurred called convexing of the water, where it was actually higher in the middle than on the sides. We were within a glass of water of having a flood of about 4,000 homes. So it was a very serious event, even in the West Bay. But what we did out of that, and because we were in a FEMA floodplain, the local residents raised money to fix the levees. They added a tax to their property tax. FEMA's a great engineer, at least in pushing people to fix things. And what happens if you're in a FEMA flood zone, which we will all be in, if you don't fix things? Well, what happens is the Ninth Ward. And it doesn't happen to happen from a flood. If you have a major earthquake that destroys 50% of the homes that you have to repair, you have to raise everything above the floodplain. And that becomes so expensive you can't repair it. So it's imperative that the work you're doing is people are paying attention to it, because it could leave areas of this Bay Area, even in an earthquake, a ghost town. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please. Carol.
Hi, I'm Carol Maloney.
Carol, move the microphone down.
Okay.
Or just tip it. Just tip it.
Okay.
There you go.
Sorry, I'm height challenged. I'm Carol Maloney. I have a couple of hats here today. I am the current chair of BAFPA, the Bay Area Flood Protection Agencies Association. I also am a representative from the Integrated Regional Water Management Plan. I am the functional area representative and also the East sub-region representative for that group. I was encouraged to see that they were included in the staff report associated with this. However, I was invited to this meeting by Jim McGrath of the Regional Board. I didn't know that this was happening, so I feel like it's important that you reach out to certain people. I'm a little bit blended in my comments today because I'm a planner, and therefore I do water supply and flood protection and think about many other agencies that we deal with. BAFPA has been working with BCDC for a while, and we've been very successful in having them come and explain climate change and sea level rise issues to us. However, there are some other models that are out there. So the flood agencies are a little bit confused about which sea level rise models we should be looking at. To be able to have a regional group that is local to the Bay Area actually give some guidance would be useful for us. So I think that that's actually a good thing that this commission would take that on. I wanted to point out a few other groups that you might want to consider. There's the stormwater agencies, BASMA, that might be a good group to also interface with because they will probably be able to facilitate projects that would help you guys out when you come up with policies. There's also some regulatory agencies. DWR commissioned a model in association with the National Academy of Sciences. They also have the hands on the purse, if you will, for the bond money, so it's important to have them involved. The Army Corps of Engineers, somebody that regulates the levees, they ultimately, if we choose to move or change levees, will have, you know, basically all of the permitting rights. And then there's also the USGS. Considering the DACs, you guys talked about that earlier in your first presentation talking about climate change, but a lot of these low-lying areas where that may get flooded are also disadvantaged communities. I think it's important to go ahead and consider that as you move forward with making your decisions. And then we also have, we've been working with SFEP and BCDC with Flood Control 2.0, which is a grant that we're working on looking at recycling sediment, if you will. You've talked about some areas in the Bay where you may have beachfront property that's being eroded away. That's something that, and also the gentleman spoke about sediment in the flood control channels. When we go in and remove that sediment, it's important to be able to recycle that and reuse it in a productive way. Thank you.
So thank you very much. Okay, Alex?
Hi, Alex Lear from the Nature Conservancy. We just wanted to strongly express our support in the recommendations for the JPC to lead a regional effort for sea level rise. The consultant's report did a great job illustrating that the criteria for selecting JPC projects were met. The funding clearly still needs to be explored, but given the preliminary work plan, we are encouraged that there's many options out there, and we trust that the committee will do a good job in analyzing all of those and reaching out where appropriate to get help that it needs. We're also pleased to see that nature-based responses are included in this report and are given priority where appropriate. And so we would strongly urge the committee to endorse the JPC in leading a regional effort on sea level rise adaptation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So could the staff address the issues raised by around silting?
Well, those are important issues, and I think it's very important to recognize that the issue before you today is not the specifics of a plan. And all of these things need to be addressed when you get into the detailed planning, but whether the JPC should take up a leadership role. And the specifics of dealing with all of those issues have to be addressed when we get into the planning. And the sediment issue is an extremely important one, as is the integration with the local flood control districts that have the major responsibility for dealing with this issue.
Okay, I have a list of speakers. I have Jim, and then I have Mary, and then I have John and Mark. So, Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I certainly support going forward the JPC taking a leadership role, but I really wish that we would You know, when you look at Task 3, you have embedded in there, it's more of a protection strategy. But I would like to see us just have a protection strategy analysis, because I think at some point we have to weigh the cost of building barriers, seawalls, and actually protecting all of the infrastructure, and then weighing that against the cost of replacement and movement of infrastructure. And so it just seems like there has to be a stronger focus on a protection strategy. I think it's just it's being diluted with all of these other types of strategies that are being presented. And so, you know, I hope as we go forward that we can really start focusing on just a protection strategy. I think there's areas that you're going to have to identify that you can't protect. And so, you know, future development in these areas, it doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, people talk about these disadvantaged communities. Maybe those disadvantaged communities need to be moved, and you know, I think there's other options that have to be looked at in the protection strategy, and I really would like to see a much stronger focus on that.
Okay, Mary, and then John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I too support it. I might want to suggest increasing the stakeholders. It gets complicated when you invite more people to the table. I understand that, but we might want to consider the five Delta counties as defined under the Delta Reform Act of the state legislation as a consideration of being a stakeholder in addition to the local flood control agencies. I think the knowledge there is very, very important. And if we can find the slide, Bruce, that goes back to the house with the levee and the drawing, thank you. You see the sea level rise on the left, but from the right is the river flow coming down, because with climate change, we're losing snowpack because the water's not freezing when it lands. It's just coming down the mountains through the rivers. So we're almost getting it from both sides. So I think the importance of the stakeholders might want to expand beyond Solano and Contra Costa County into the other three Delta counties. And lastly, we might want to consider an element of water storage to be a component of this somewhere, somehow. It should not be considered esoteric, because, again, when we're losing the snowpack, which is water storage for us as a state, that whether you're north or south, whether you're an in-Delta water user or an exporter, we need to capture the water when it's available. And when we consider we're losing the snowpack, we're not capturing what we may. We may not have the ability to store it when we can capture it.
We actually are starting looking at some of our flood issues in Berkeley, and I just wanted to point out we look at watershed. We're now thinking about trying to incorporate what Jeremy was saying. Instead of just having a pipe that runs down, we're now thinking about having storage along the way where we actually store it, you know, ourselves, and try to catch it so that it doesn't have this big surge, but you can have little places along the way as it comes down.
It's called regional self-sufficiency.
Yeah, something like that. But it's, John.
Yeah, I think all of these good comments are going to be the kind of things that will come up in our discussion. That's the whole, today we're just sort of saying, should we facilitate this effort? And I know the executive committee of JPC agreed with that recommendation from the executive directors. And getting back to Scott's point, Scott, I think the fact that it's going to broaden out will take away this whole DART mentality. I mean, when BCDC was dealing with it, right, it was a view that it was one agency, even though it had representatives from local and state government. This is much broader, involves all of local government, involves all the regional agencies. So BCDC limited its Bay Plan amendment to only cover the area that BCDC has jurisdiction over. This is going to be much broader than that, and rightly, it will include all level, you know, all local government and additional stakeholders, as others have said. I think even a lot of the agencies that you've talked about on flood control, they've been tuned into this discussion for years. I know Mitch Avalon, who, you know, from Contra Costa, has had a lot of discussion with flood control agencies. So all of these folks, I think, are going to be brought to the table. And, you know, and the range of alternatives, Jim, are going to come up in the discussion, will get shaped. So I think what I see is this work plan is like a living document, right? It's going to change over time, but it's meant to give us an idea of what it is we're going to be looking at as we start this process. So I support. And for that, I will put a motion on the floor to move forward with this based on the recommendation.
Seconded by someone, I didn't get Scott. Okay. David, just a second. I have a Mark and then Dave.
Yeah, just a couple things. The
what you have in Berkeley, Mr. Mayor, about your stormwater retention, those retention basins feeding the water in gradually. And what in Martinez, what we've looked at is our drainage mitigation fees, trying to encourage people to recharge the water, not pump it into the drainage system. And we came about that. If you look at this picture, you can see the water is the color of the water. It's muddy. And we talked about siltation. And when I was a kid growing up in Martinez, when we had floods, which we had a lot more of, the water was clear when it ran in the streets and ran out of the creek. It was a lot clearer than this. The problem that we found, that's the practical problem, is the mud. After the water leaves, it's the mud and the expense of cleaning up all the mud. If we found, we were talking about how if we can save that at the front end by getting people not to discharge so much water into the system, then we might have a reduced cost whenever it does flood. On the larger, on the regional scale, if you look at green, people say, why are you guys worried about greenhouse gases in the Bay Area? It's a global issue. Well, if you look at, if your community can reduce by a couple percent the amount of water that flows into the Bay by some of these methods of drainage mitigation, you might reduce the problem in the region just that much. I know it seems overwhelming, but just that little reduction can help. And also, the fees, the drainage mitigation fees or NPDES fees, may be something we could look at funding the policy overlook that we're talking about here. Thank you.
Dave?
Just pursuant to my previous inquiry, I'm wondering if it makes sense to include coordination with the urban SIM model under subtask 1.2, you know, particularly just so it's called out early. I think there's a modeling, a demonstration of that going on at the next RPC meeting, ABAG's RPC, which I chair in about a week with a whole bunch of other stakeholders. And it just seems the further that goes along without this being integrated in, the more backfilling that's going to have to be done later. Anyway, just any kind of language that just calls for that coordination to happen under subtask 1.2. I'm sure it would happen anyway, but it made me feel better if it was there in black and white.
Hello.
Should be directed to the maker of the motion.
You want to make a comment, Marion?
Just as I think Steve has indicated, we are, this model is in the process of development, and for this SES, I think we are at capacity in terms of how many factors we can include. It's definitely a component that needs to be integrated. We have been working with BCDC in terms of data and mapping and doing overlays of existing population, existing housing, existing infrastructure, potential growth, and some of the information that BCDC has compiled. So we do have some coordination, but I think, as Dave indicated, that can gain a higher level of sophistication in the future. But not necessarily within the cycle of the urban SIM.
Well, so I would, as the maker of the motion, or the seconder of the motion, agree to the amendment that, you know, puts some sort of language in there that it coordinates with urban SIMs. So I don't know how the maker of the motion feels about that, but I'm certainly amenable to that.
You okay with that, maker of the motion? Okay. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to request the comments from the public and members were also included to be carried forward through staff in this process. That would be my request to the maker and the seconder of the motion.
Okay.
Thank
you.
We
have a motion and a second. Why don't we do a hand vote? Anyone all in favor, would you please raise your hands? Okay. Looks like, David, are you voting? I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So it looks like it's unanimous. Okay, thank you very much. We have two people who are non-voters who are observers of this. So we now have an opportunity. Thank you very much. I think this is a major step forward, and I think we should compliment the staff and the executive directors for helping to shape this, because I think we're really making significant progress, so I appreciate that. We now have committee comments. Anyone want to make some comments? Okay, the public comments. I don't have any cards. Anyone in the public wish to address the JPC? Okay, guess what? We're going to be out on time, you guys. And I'd like to indicate we're having our next meeting is November the, let's see, 16th? Is that what it says? 16th? And at that meeting, we will be selecting a chair for the next couple of years. So if anyone's interested in taking that position, you should maybe let us know so we can. Okay?
4 more years.